Welcome to our special arena marking the start of ISL Awareness Week, and welcome to the ISL community as well. Tonight's arena will be signed by ISL interpreter Catherine White, and you can see herself and myself and watch tonight's show on the RTE News Channel and on rte.ie/arena. On the show tonight, we're discussing the new RTE drama The Walsh Sisters and the Tony Award-winning play The Sound Inside, and the film Seven is 30. You can, as usual, contact us on 51551, and on Instagram you'll find RTE_arena is where we are. The Walsh Sisters, a six-part series based on the beloved novels of Marion Keyes, begins this Sunday at 9:30 on RTE1. The darkly funny and emotionally raw drama brings to life the tangled world of Anna, Rachel, Claire, Maggie and Helen Walsh. At its heart, the series is about love, loyalty and the destructive patterns that run through families. Written by Stephanie Prisner and directed by Ian Fitzgibbon, it boasts a stellar cast led by Louisa Harland, Caroline Menton, Danielle Galligan, Mairead Tyres and Prisner herself as Maggie. I'm joined in studio now by director Ian Fitzgibbon and Stephanie Prisner. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Stephanie, I'm going to start with you. Talk to me about getting this job.
Getting this job. So I'll take you back to a time when nobody had any idea what COVID was. It was 2018 and Cuba Pictures had acquired the rights for Marion's intellectual property for the Walsh Sisters. And I don't know the ins and outs of it, but I know that I had to fly to London with my agent and sit in front of two of the executives and pitch how I would do this and how I would do this series. And because it's, you know, there are five books, they are, each of the books is about one sister. So like in Rachel's book, Rachel is 30, but Helen is like 15. But then in Helen's book, Helen is 30 and Rachel has moved on with her life from her book. So I had to find a way to get all of these characters into the same world at the same time, which meant, you know, I imagine them as kind of faders on a sound desk. And in this season, Rachel and Anna are kind of dialed up to 10 and the others are at like 6, 5 and 4, 3-ish. And in my head, that was the only way I could kind of see to do it, to have them all in the same time, but without each of their... So Anna and Rachel both have kind of the plots of their books playing out in this season, whereas the others are just, we're kind of laying seeds for future seasons.
It is immensely complicated, though, because you are dealing with so many characters who don't necessarily cross over in exactly the same way in those books. When you were coming together with your pitch for this, did you have one of those boards that had lines running from someone to someone else? And then was that a complicated process?
I didn't have lines, but that's what my brain does. It kind of holds it all as a kind of a Rubik's cube where each of the characters and each of the plots is a square and I try to kind of line them up. And it's okay that one side of the square is all the correct colour, even though there's chaos on the other sides of the Rubik's cube, because to me, those are future seasons. And I very much, like, I grew up with Marion Keyes in my house. Like, I challenge anyone listening tonight, if you live in a house where there has ever been a tin of USA biscuits at Christmas, I challenge you not to now look on a bookshelf and find a Marion Keyes book. Like, Marion Keyes is as ubiquitous in Irish households as the Sacred Heart of Jesus picture. You know, like, she is, I'm not equating her with our Lord and Saviour.
Is this your John Lennon moment?
What?
Is this your John Lennon moment?
I don't know what that means, but I know that John Lennon was in the Beatles. Okay. That's all I know.
We won't go down the bigger than Jesus route.
Okay. So it was a big task, and I had always been aware of Marion Keyes. She's so beloved. So I think the biggest part of the task was the pressure to meet an audience who are evangelical about these characters at a place where, you know, I'm not going to do a word for word representation. This is not set in the 90s as her books were. Things have changed in Ireland. And
you did that brilliantly.
Yeah. Well, I hope so. Because
yeah, you did. You did that. I mean,
that almost sounds like that's the first time you've said that to her.
No. But I mean, Marion has acknowledged this. But I certainly thought when I was first approached to do it, I've only been involved this is a year of my life, maybe slightly 14 months more than a year. But the thing that I think Steph has really done incredibly well is to take books that are beloved and they are almost sacred texts. But she has And with Marion's support, I think she has brought them into today's world. Because, you know, Rachel's Holiday, which is one of the main stories that we deal with, and that book is 30 years old. So there are many things that Steph did very subtly to where she retained the truth of the characters and the characters and their situations, but she really freshened it up and she brought her own voice to it, which you have to do when you take on books and you turn them into pictures, you know. So certainly from my perspective, I feel like what the work that she's done has really, she's sort of elevated what Marion has done, but she's also transformed it into something that's very, very visual and very, that a camera can look at and make live, which is really important.
Because I suppose the question for you is, what draws you to this as a director? What makes this something that when you see it...
It's the same thing that always draws me. You know, it's the first thing that I look at is talent. Somebody gave me advice years ago when I started being a director. She said, always stay close to talent. And when I look at Stephanie... And I looked at her scripts,
but makes you, that undermines the talent that you have, because that makes you sound like one of those like talentless lurks who hangs around stage doors like trying to stay close to talent.
What I mean is, I'm not being falsely modest. I do think I'm a very good director, but what I'm saying is, what gets me excited is good gear. So if somebody gives me a script that I feel like I'm connected to, that I feel like I can believe. And I suppose the thing that makes me happiest about the stories that we've told are exactly the thing you mentioned in your opening, which is that balance of finding what's funny in the darkness. You know, it's making the darkness bearable, but it's not shining away from the dark stuff. I mean, you know, we deal with addiction, we deal with grief, and those are very prominent themes in our story. But it never goes very long without it being funny. And that, I do think, is a very happy hybrid of Prisoner and Keys. You know, they really complement each other so beautifully. And I think that's what will make, I genuinely think that when people watch it, they'll feel that authenticity. They'll feel the freshness. We have some relatively unknown actors in our series. I suppose Aidan Quinn is a bit of a name, but there's no sense of this being a star vehicle. It's these five actors, including Stephanie, who are just, they've just grabbed those characters and made them their own. And that's why I think it's as strong as it is.
Well, maybe before we move on, I'm going to play a clip from the first episode. This is Mammy Walsh, who is Carrie Crowley. And she'd like to go on a cruise now that the girls are all grown. And Jack Walsh, who's the daddy, who is Aidan Quinn, he's not so sure.
Mick Clifford took Sandra on the Shannon as a surprise. 25 years to be married, and Clonmacnoise noise is the best he can do. Well, then at least Mick Clifford still takes his wife places, even if it is awfully.
Are we enough to be doing here?
Our girls are gone, Jack. I'm ready for my postpartum adventure. It's only been, what, 35 years?
Well, Helen's not gone. She's still here.
Yeah, but she's at college. Anna and Rachel are away with their own lives. As for Claire, she needs to stop relying on us to do everything with Kate.
She is our granddaughter.
Exactly. We're done. I want to go somewhere. Somewhere there's no drama. Maybe a cruise.
No drama. A cruise. People die on cruises.
Do not.
They do so. I read it online. I'll send you a link. They go there to die. It's cheaper than a hospice.
Those two absolutely crack me up every time I watch this. And I watch it a lot, but I just howl at Mammy and Daddy. They are just so funny.
Their timing is particularly perfect as a double act.
It is, and they're so droll. And I remember we were shooting one day and Carrie had some dental thing, and she came back and we were just asking her, like, how's it going? And she was like, oh yeah, the doctor put me on steroids. And Aidan Quinn was like, oh Jesus, Carrie Crowley on steroids. It was just really funny. They have such a lovely relationship.
They really do.
But before I move on, I do want to ask you just once more about the idea of adapting Marion and her being this kind of national institution. I mean, there must have been an incredible pressure, maybe not externally but internally, in terms of you taking Marion's work and being the first person to bring it and put it on screen. Did you feel any of that, or did you manage to put that in a box?
So I didn't feel any of that until last Wednesday night. So because this is all, like, I've had a solid career making shows that have never been made. Like, I've had some shows that have been made, but you can earn a living writing television that never actually makes it to screen. And Marion has written books, and those books have been optioned for screen before. And so she has, I've known her from before I got this job, and we never, throughout all of those years, we never spoke about the work. I got engaged, I had a lot of infertility issues, I had two children, all of those things. Marion, as my friend, I would text, we would meet up, and we would never talk about the work. And then one day last year, Ian and I were auditioning Rachel's, and we had a big long day of auditions, and Dixie, our executive producer, messaged me and she said, we have a Zoom call with Marion at one. And I said, I can't do a Zoom with Marion at one, I have auditions. And she was like, no, you have to be on this Zoom, like, we need to update her and fill her in, and you know her, you know, like, you need to be on this call. So I rang around the agents and was like, look, I'm really sorry, can we push this actor's, you know, audition back? And we organised all that. So I come on this Zoom, and you know Marion, anyone who's ever seen Marion on TV or on radio, you know how enthusiastic she is, and how she speaks in capital letters, you know, and you can almost hear the emojis coming out of her, and she's so beautiful and enthusiastic and good natured. And she was kind of withholding, you know, and I was like, okay, so here we are, and these scripts are done, and thanks for the notes on that, and, you know, blah, 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 just talking about the next steps. And she was like, okay, great, okay, yeah. And I was like, listen, I better go because I have another Rachel coming to audition. And she was like, sorry, what? I was like, oh, Marion, like, I am in the audition room pausing the auditions. I think we've just found our Rachel. This is happening. And the minute I said that, like, this dam burst and the enthusiasm came through the screen. She was like, oh my goodness, I didn't think it was actually happening. Are you serious? You can use my wardrobe and I have a lovely coat that you can wear and you can have my house. And giving me the shirt off her back. And I was like, no, we're fine, we have a costume department, but, you know, this is actually happening. So I even still then, it wasn't really the weight of the Marion Keyes things, but it was when we were all at the premiere on Wednesday night and there were her supporters and fans were there, and I was like, oh God, this is the first time people are going to see Ian and my interpretation of these sacred texts. Mm. And all of a sudden the weight of it hit me. But I think she's done an amazing job at galvanizing her fans, keeping them on side, you know, almost the way.
But you have been a very good guardian as well of her work, I feel. Like, you were very,
I have, yeah.
You were very, we used to have these conversations on set when we were dealing with the more dramatic side. By the way, my first interview as a director was for Rachel's Holiday, the movie, 23 years ago. I'd wrote and directed a series here called Paths to Freedom. Mm-hmm. And some English producer saw it and said, I'd like you to come over and meet, I think it was Alison Owen, who's Lily Allen's mom, I think.
Okay.
Was doing Rachel's Holiday. And
but that never got made, did it?
No, never got made. But I'm just saying that these things are in the ether for so long. It's extraordinary. It's just, that's part of the business that we're in. But to go back to what Stephanie did was she had a really good line of communication with Marion. She kept that open. But Marion, I thought, was so generous to us, wasn't she?
So generous.
She really allowed us to go, well, this is how we see it, Marion. This is how, I mean, we shared the castings with her.
Mm-hmm.
And she kind of always agreed with us. I think, didn't she?
Yeah, she did.
Very, very seldom did she differ. And she was always, like, if she saw little clips, she was always very positive.
She was very generous when she wasn't. Like, so, for example, she read the scripts, and Mammy Walsh is very famous, right? And she is called Mammy Walsh in the books. And as I adapted it, she was called Mammy as her character name, but the girls would also refer to her as Mammy. And she came back and very generously was like, she has to be called Mum. Like, she wouldn't be called Mammy, mm-hmm. She'd be called Mum. And I was like, oh yes, of course. And then, you know, when I was meeting the costume department, I sent her a picture of the engagement ring that they got for Maggie. And I was like, I don't think this is right. Do you think this is right? And she was like, no. And she sent me back four pictures of, like, what Maggie's engagement ring would look like. And another time I was like, I need to know what political party Daddy Walsh is in. I think I know, but can you confirm? She was like, yeah, absolutely, Fianna Fáil. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. And then our British producer was like, the British people are not going to understand what Fianna Fáil means. And I was like, so? They can Google it. 800 years. Like, I watch British television and I have to Google things. And she was like, could you not change it to Labour? And I was like, Labour? Are you joking? Absolutely not. He's a Fianna Fáiler.
It's a different character. Look, you wrote the series, but you also play one of the Walsh sisters. You play Maggie. Was that always going to be the case from day one? Or is that something that came about? And if so, where?
No.
I think I'm partly responsible for that.
Okay.
I think what happened was...
Mostly.
Totally, yes. Well, Maureen, our casting director, is very encouraging as well. What happens is when we were auditioning all these actors, myself and Steph would read opposite the actors. More often than not, Steph was reading opposite because she was playing a sister to somebody who hadn't been cast. Mm. And I kept watching her and I had a private conversation with our casting director and I was kind of looking at her and I was thinking, I just think Steph would be a really interesting Maggie. You know, she has a lot of those qualities for free, but she has also got good timing. She has a nice kind of naturalism about her. And also she's pretty distinct to the four others. So I said, I think you should do it. So I had to have a little chat with people in RTE who were slightly surprised saying, but she's going to have to write. And I said, yeah, but she's written a lot of it already. And they, you know, to be fair to them, it's a good point because it was a lot of work for Steph. So when we were on set and I was directing her, sometimes I had to pull her aside and say, you know, OK, this is not about the script. This is about just Maggie. Mm-hmm. So Stephanie Prisner has to leave the room and we're just dealing with Maggie. And I think she trusted me enough and we had enough trust in each other that really worked. And I'm really glad it turned out the way. And then she convinced me to be in it in a much smaller role.
But so. but an important role all the same. So we needed in episode four and five. Just four. Oh, in episode four, there's a guy who he's in it for maybe two or three scenes. But you know, one of those kind of key characters who moves the plot on to the next thing. And because Ian Fitzgibbon, for those of you who are listening and not watching, you will recognise if you do see him from our favourite episode of Father Ted when. When Ted kicked Bishop Brennan up the arse and Ian was Bishop Brennan's sycophantic sidekick.
I was.
So he's well able to act as well.
I wasn't going to bring that up because I thought it was too far in the past, but if you've done it, that's
well,
fun.
There no. we are. Listen, I'm proud. I'm proud to be a Father Ted veteran.
Despite the addiction and the recovery being the heart of this story, Stephanie, it is a really, really funny show. Mm-hmm. How do you balance that as a writer? Because you've obviously got to take one part of it very seriously, but then kind of cut it through with the other.
Yeah, but I think that's what Irish people do best. That's what Marion does. That's not a new recipe I've created. Like, that's something that I think, you know, as a writer, I am strong at. And not all writers are. Some writers love to dwell in the marsh of depression. And I don't. I like to kind of skim the stone across the sea and kind of make a joke in the same tone of all my work. Like, Salpadine is My Boyfriend was about addiction. And you make people laugh, reel them in. And then when they're close enough to you from laughing, you stab them in the heart with, you know, with the sad bit. And I think Marion's tone is that as well. You know, Rachel's Holiday is called Rachel's Holiday. It's got a pink cover and a flip-flop on the front of it. And you bring it on holidays and you read it. And then you find yourself sobbing on a beach being like, oh my God, I relate so much to this girl. Like, if that book was called The Girl with a Needle in Her Arm, people wouldn't...
Might not have sold so well.
Yeah, might not have sold so well. And that tone is sacrosanct. And that is the tone that, you know, I used to say to Ian when we were on set and we were getting into the darker stuff. I used to say pink covers, like, let's hide the vegetables in the sauce here, because if it's too... It's Sunday night at 9:35. Like, nobody wants to be really, really... And, like, we're coming after traitors, you know? People have gotten used to a very, very exciting Sunday night, and I want to keep that up.
I'm going to take another clip from the series. This is your character, Maggie, arriving for Sunday lunch. She's well prepared. She has all of the gifts for her sisters to give to Mammy Walsh. And we hear Mairead Tyres as Helen in this and Danielle Galligan as Claire.
So you have two options. You have flowers or chocolate.
You are such a licker.
What?
You'd always complain about mum's demands and then you'd give in to them.
Yeah, Helen, for a quiet lunch.
In fairness, you have created a monster to a point.
Thank you.
I'm going to watch the golf with Jack.
Okay, bye. Hello.
Hiya. Sorry, thank you so much for getting those bits, Maggie.
You have two options, chocolate or cookies.
I'm not giving her chocolates or biscuits. She'll say I'm a feeder.
Well, they're the only options I have, Claire. She's not wrong, though.
Mum's already in a bad mood because Dad fell asleep at Mass.
I'll give her the flowers.
You'll kill them.
I'm giving them to her in like 5 minutes.
Still.
I'm capable of keeping things alive. Thank you very much. You sound like James.
How is James?
I have to be careful now because of Elsevier's.
Kate, we go inside and say hi to Nanny and Grandad?
Yeah. Where's Auntie Rachel?
Shall we see if she's inside?
Okay.
Right, go on about James.
He wants me to bring her over because he's missing the birthday tomorrow. Just exhausted. I'm dragging her through airports. Like, why is it always me that goes over there?
I know. But she loves to see him. And he loves to see her.
Don't do that, Maggie. You always take a side.
I don't. I'm just saying you should bring her.
I will, don't I always? I'm just saying that being a parent is a gender imbalanced cesspool.
Okay.
Tell me in a little bit about the visual look of this, because sometimes it can be hard not to make Dublin look overly familiar in a series.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I was very specific when I sat down with our incredible cameraman, JJ Rolf. I spent months trawling references. So I had about 200 references, 200 stills from various things. And one of the things that I very early, I sat down with Steph in the Intercontinental Hotel and we were trying to conceive the sort of the structure of an episode. And I started to show her the pictures and the references that I had in my head. And what I really wanted to do was I really wanted to give this kind of very aesthetically pleasing view of Dublin. It slightly lies because every time you look at it, it's sunny and there's flowers and we show a lot of that lovely Black Rock coastline and the Dart. But it's also what part of Dublin is. And I was just very keen that it just feel very visually rich and romantic and filmic. So I won't get technical about it, but there are a lot of lenses that I use that have a very kind of narrow depth of field, which means you stay very close to the characters and what's behind them tends to fall away. So I became obsessed with depth and I kept saying to our production designer, give me depth, give me hallways, give me lights. If there are no lights, create them. If there's no building to create a light, tell lies, just put them up there. Just to give it a feeling I guess it's a romantic view of Dublin, I think. Isn't that fair to say, would you say?
And also because my writing is quite yappy, like it's very wordy and it's people talking to each other and often two people talking to each other. And Ian would say to me, like, God, these scenes, they're very long, like there's a lot of words. And I said, yeah, but that's the way it's going to be. And so it's your job to, if people get bored of listening, that they have something in the background to rest their eyes on. And I was kind of inspired by, what's the name of that guy, Richard Curtis? Is he the guy who made Notting Hill?
Yeah.
So like, you know, he sets those scenes, like, and there's a beautiful bookcase in the background. And if you're bored of what they're talking about or you feel like you've heard that scene before, you can like look in the background and pick out the titles and stuff. That I felt that this, like, we had, the book is so rich and Marion does this amazing job of creating these characters where you get their inner world and their outer world and how they feel about everything. And TV is less deep than that. Like, unless you're going to do a voiceover, it's really hard to get an idea of somebody's internal world. And so we had these, like, this tiny amount of real estate where on a screen we had what they were saying and what we were looking at and what we were hearing, which came up in post-production and has elevated it completely. But I wasn't thinking about music when I wrote it. So Ian and JJ have done this kind of amazing thing by taking the inspiration of Richard Curtis, working title, all that sort of like dewy romantic stuff.
In terms Korean of music, drama, I took a lot of shots from Korean drama. I'm obsessed with Korean drama.
Now that you've mentioned music, Amy Carty, there's a couple of her.
Oh my God.
I'm astonished because I don't think I've ever heard her stuff anywhere else other than on this program, and she's great.
She's incredible. You Stephanie Prysner.
Yeah, I found that song while I was writing, and I said to Ian, I always like speak in absolutes, and I said to Ian, like, this is the song for the show. And he would laugh at me and go, Stephanie, you can't make those decisions now. Like, we'll talk about it. And then we would like audition lots of different songs and I'd be like, see, I told you.
That song, in fairness.
No, you did love that song from the jump.
That broke my heart right from the off. But Steph is right. She does have these incredibly strong, like she said, she sent me a clip of Caroline Menton and she said, that's our Rachel. At least 2 months before we saw her. And I said, I think I'll be the judge of that. And then we auditioned her. I swear this is true. We auditioned her, and Steph was in the corner of a room, and I was auditioning Caroline Minton, and she was so incredible. I just turned and I looked at Steph, and Steph just went
big smug look on my head, sitting on my high horse.
So perfect. So I think Steph, you have incredible instincts. You really do.
Yeah. So Amy Carty provides us with the song that opens our show in episode one, finishes our show in episode six, and another song, Child Again, which is I think in part three of episode one. She came to our launch on Wednesday, and she's just so sweet and so incredibly talented.
Yeah.
I think she's still, if people look at even her numbers on Spotify, they're not enormous. I think after this, that's going to change very much.
Absolutely.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. She deserves it.
I want to ask you about the podcast, because unlike a lot of other dramas, there is a podcast happening on this series.
The Walsh Sisters
with
official.
You and Marion Keyes.
Yeah, so the Walsh Sisters official podcast is going to... So every Sunday night, an episode will go out on RT1 on TV. And then afterwards, the podcast will go live wherever you get your podcasts. But there's also, you know, a watch along podcast after the episode on RT Player, if you want to watch Marion and I. We have different people each episode. Ian joins us in episode four, different actors. All the sisters join us at some point, and Aidan Quinn, Jay Duffy, who plays Luke. And the first episode is kind of about what you've just seen and the process of adapting it and how we got to there. And then each episode, we kind of dissect the episode, behind the scenes insights, and, you know, what it was like to film it, alongside the actors and how they prepared for the roles and stuff. So I think it'll be like, it's kind of, you know, one of those, when you watch something these days, we're so used to binging that often if you're limited to a single episode, you can be like, I want more. Well, this will give you that and keep you going for the next week.
It has been great to talk to both of you tonight, Stephanie Prisner and Ian Fitzgibbon. Thanks a million for joining me. The Walsh Sisters starts this coming Sunday, the 28th of September at 9:30 on RTE1 and on the RTE Player. The Walsh Sisters, the official podcast presented by Marion Keyes and Stephanie Prisner, will be available directly after each episode on the RTE Radio Player or wherever you get your podcasts. Nominated for 6 Tony Awards, the critically acclaimed play The Sound Inside by Adam Rapp will have its Irish premiere at this year's Dublin Theatre Festival. It's the story of an Ivy League professor who encounters a brilliant but mysterious student and how an unexpected intense bond develops between them. Fresh from a sellout season at the Traverse Theatre in Edinburgh, the play opens at the Pavilion in Dunleary this Wednesday, and its actors Madeleine Potter and Eric Sirokian join me in studio this evening. Welcome to the programme.
Thanks for having us.
Madeleine, you play a creative writing professor named Bella Baird. She's approached by one of her students, Christopher Dunn, who's a freshman. Tell us more about them and about where the story starts.
The play is works on many levels. It's a memory play that comes into the present. The writer, Adam Rapp, calls it a haunting. She's a creative writing professor. He's her student. And they form this extraordinary bond. They're extremely connected through literature. Literature is their love language. And in the play, it develops, and I won't give away what happens in the end, because that's one of the amazing things about seeing it, is I think it's probably impossible to imagine where it goes. I certainly didn't when I read it the first time. Eric actually sent it to me, and I read it and was absolutely overwhelmed by it. It felt like a couple of minutes had gone by, and I was in floods of tears, and I wrote him back and said, I agree, I think we've got to try to do this play.
So Eric, talk to me about that process then, about how the two of you came to make this together.
It came about in a really unusual way. Usually actors don't generate projects. Usually... it comes from producers and directors. But in this case, I had read a draft of the play that a friend from New York had sent my way and said, I think you'd be really good in this. And I didn't get to see it when it was first on in New York. So I only had the script as my frame of reference. And I knew Madeleine. We had met and we ran into each other again. And this was a couple years maybe after I'd read the play, and I don't know why, after seeing her again, I just thought of it suddenly and thought, well, she has to play that part. That's the perfect part for her. So it was quite random. I asked for her email from a mutual friend. I sent it her way. We didn't know each other very well, so this was a shot in the dark.
We'd met twice.
Yeah, right? We'd only met twice.
But the first time we had an amazing conversation, but that was years before.
Yeah, so yeah, we weren't really in each other's lives in a meaningful way. Madeline responded to the play immediately, and what I had kind of floated the idea to her as just a crazy idea, like, wouldn't we be great in this? But she got very serious about it very fast and said, not only yes, but we must do it. So we met quite soon after with a really wonderful producer, one of your own, Porik Cusack, from this part of the world. And he loved the play. He brought on board a really fantastic director, Matt Wilkinson.
Who also brought on an amazing creative team.
Who comes with some of the best designers in the world. They're all kind of a package deal, which is really cool. And the most amazing part, perhaps, is that we approached the writer with our crazy idea, and he said yes.
Because this is an unusual thing to have happen. You Adam Rapp himself became a whole part of this process for you, despite the fact that he wasn't initially involved at all.
Mm. That's right. I think Porik approached his agent. And at the same time all this was happening, I had formed a theater company, which was actually the idea of Robert Jackson, Half Moon Street, who's the other producer, along with Porik, said, I'd like to produce a play for you. And there was an extraordinary serendipity that surrounded this entire story right up to now. But we, including that Eric and I both happened to be in New York, not even a year and a half ago, December 2023, and we met Adam twice and had amazing conversations with him. And then he came to London and we did a workshop and married some of his earlier version with what had been the Broadway version. It was republished. And that was an incredible few days, wasn't it? Just absolutely astonishing. And what we're doing here in Dublin really feels like a sort of direct line from that workshop in so many ways.
So I guess the point of this whole long story is that it is truly, in the truest sense, a passion project. We were drawn to the material out of pure love for it, and our kind of year and a half journey with it has been nothing but
astonishing. That the doors kept opening. I mean, divine serendipity, right, all the way through. So lucky.
About the play itself, I want to ask maybe the same question to both of you. How do you explain the way in which your characters are drawn to one another? Because they've both got an interesting relationship with books.
I think that they're absolutely drawn together by art, by literature. They're both writers. One of the things that's interesting is that there's a great age difference, and she's in her 50s, and he's a freshman at university, but they speak the same language, and neither of them is a person who has a lot of friends. That's made clear in the play. They're sort of loners. Loneliness is a theme in the play, and their connection is just profound.
And they're outsiders.
Yes.
They are artistic soulmates, I guess.
Yeah.
What do you know by heart the Dostoevsky quote?
At the end, I do.
In the letter. Because I can say it, but I'm gonna paraphrase. There's a beautiful quote from Crime and Punishment that's in the play, which is about
sometimes we encounter people, even perfect strangers, who begin to interest us at first sight, somehow suddenly, all at once, before a word is spoken.
And that does explain the relationship between
that's Dostoevsky. And I would say that it absolutely says it, and certainly in a greater way than I ever could.
It feels like, for both of them, I think, a kind of once-in-a-lifetime occurrence.
Yeah, they are each other's other. They are each other's... other, but it doesn't materialize in any way that's conventional. But another thing that absolutely fascinated me when we did it in Edinburgh was people who love literature and love words will love the play. It's an absolutely brilliant play. It's one of the best plays I've read in years. He's an incredible writer, and it's really an astonishing play. But although a lot of literature is in it and is quoted, people responded to it profoundly, whether they loved books and read all the time or hardly ever read. And that's part of the magic of the play.
I think it is because it's not always necessarily the case in a play like this, but some of your monologues, some of your characters' monologues, they read like a short story. They read like sections of something from The New Yorker.
That's right. And I feel that you can tell what kind of writer she is by how she speaks. Yes, you can tell that she is a very good writer by how she speaks. It's so brilliant that way as an invention of storytelling.
Eric, the play itself, it's set within that highly elite atmosphere of Yale, but literature itself isn't portrayed as being elitist. There's an accessible, inclusive feel throughout the play. I mean, anybody can feel drawn into it.
Yeah, well, my character, Christopher, is very much an outsider to that posh, elite, Ivy League world. I think that's part of why it is so accessible and compelling, because we are in this world, but we meet characters who are somewhat removed from it. And the way that Christopher and I think also Bella understands literature, it's through the heart. It's not through the intellect. It's not through a particular upper class upbringing. It's not
conventional.
Yeah,
it's completely experiential and therefore human and accessible.
And their writing too, which we get glimpses of, is so, but for both of them, so visceral and so passionate and heartfelt. And it's, you sense that it's two people who don't have many ways of expressing themselves or many people to express themselves to. And they find a way to connect and to share how they feel about the world through stories.
Yes.
Actors Madeline Potter and Eric Sorokin, thanks for joining us this evening on Arena. The Sound Inside by Adam Rapp is directed by Matt Wilkinson, and the producer is Padraig Cusack. It opens this Wednesday, the 24th of September, and runs until October 5th at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary. 30 years ago, a serial killer film called Irredeemably Bleak was released that had audiences on the edge of their seats, myself included, until the final moments. And had one of the greatest endings in cinema history. It's Seven and starred the great Morgan Freeman and Brad Pitt as two detectives on the hunt for a serial killer using the seven deadly sins as a template. Joining me now, Stephen Benedict, lecturer at the National Film School, who's been reviewing Seven for us. Stephen, before you remind us about the film, let's take a listen to Morgan Freeman in an early scene from the film.
Long is the way and hard that out of hell leads up to light.
It's from Milton. Paradise Lost.
All right. I'm confused.
It means that this is beginning. This was found behind the same refrigerator. Written in Greece. There are seven deadly sins, Captain. Gluttony. Greed. Sloth. Wrath. Pride. Lust. And envy. Seven. You can expect five more of these.
That's Morgan Freeman listing off the seven deadly sins to the police captain played by R. Lee Ermey, discovering an insight into the mind of the serial killer. Stephen, before we dig in, for people who've maybe never seen the film before, give us a brief overview of the plot.
Okay. Brad Pitt plays a young rookie cop, a detective who's just arrived in the big city, an unnamed city, and he is going to be not trained in, but he's going to be acclimatized to the life of the big city by the retiring Morgan Freeman, who retires in 7 days. And on that day, they discover the first victim in a series of victims, and it appears that the victims are being murdered on the motivation of the seven deadly sins. So they've got seven sins to track down for seven crimes in 7 days. And inevitably, Morgan Freeman decides, I'm not going to give up just yet. I'm going to see this one through. So that's really the central premise to the story.
Where does the film come from? How does this all begin, the origin point of its making?
Okay, it began life back in 1986 when aspiring screenwriter Andrew Kevin Walker recently graduated from Penn State University, and he thought the best way for me to break into Hollywood was to go to New York and start working in Tower Records. It's an obvious route, right? But he reckoned that what he called then a 40-hour week dead-end job working in Tower Records would actually finance his writing so he could write at night. And so going to and from work across New York and across Manhattan, he was witnessing a crack epidemic, which was ravaging the city. It was like turning blocks into open hell. And it was those visions and that sight that inspired him to come up with a premise about a serial killer who's using the seven deadly sins as the motivation to murder people. So the thing was that when he's writing the script in the 1980s, the problem was that serial killer movies back then were considered to be the lowest common denominator of exploitation, trash, Z-scale films. But then when he had finished writing the script, The Silence of the Lambs had been released, and $275 million later and five Oscars later, suddenly serial killer scripts were hot. His script landed on the desk of a producer called Arnold Copelson. Copelson had won the Oscar for producing Platoon. Copelson loved the script and immediately sent it out and approached actors such as Al Pacino, Sylvester Stallone and Denzel Washington. Each one of them said no for the same reason, the violence. So immediately Copelson turned around to Andrew Kevin Walker and said, rewrite it and tone down the violence. And he approaches directors such as David Cronenberg and a very young Guillermo del Toro, and they both turn it down. And then he goes back to Kevin Walker and says, write it again, dilute the violence and change that bleak ending. So that's really where Seven starts.
And where does David Fincher come into this? Because this is obviously long before The Social Network, Fight Club, Gone Girl. He'd almost counted himself out of ever making another film after making his Alien film.
Yeah, he said it was like torture, and he wants that movie to be expunged from his CV forever. But the thing was, prior to that, Fincher's directorial career began when he started directing commercials and pop videos. And if anybody remembers Madonna's Vogue and Madonna's Express Yourself and George Michael's Freedom and Aerosmith's Janie's Got a Gun, they were all directed by David Fincher. So he has this very strong visual style to his palette. But also in addition to that, he was making commercials, and his very, very first TV commercial was banned by the FCC in the United States because it was an anti-smoking ad for the American Cancer Society, and it showed a fetus smoking a cigarette and was banned. And when Copelson realised that he had directed that commercial, he said, that's the guy to direct this picture, because he's not afraid of confronting something head on. And if it's dark and depressing and bleak, he will deliver dark, depressing and bleak.
Okay, the relationship obviously between Morgan Freeman and Brad Pitt is key. If it doesn't work, the film doesn't work. Why do you think they're so good together?
Because they have different energies. I mean, Morgan Freeman, think about it, how it might not have worked. Because if you cast Denzel Washington, which role do you play him in? He's going to be the younger cop. And again, maybe Sylvester Stallone or Al Pacino in the older cop. Al Pacino is a firecracker of an actor when he goes as hoo-ha, all that sort of stuff. Or is he going to play it completely subdued like he did with Michael Corleone? But if you put Morgan Freeman in the older role, he's wiser, he's more calm. And he's sort of not stoic, but he's resigned to the evils of the world. And Brad Pitt comes across as this firecracker guy. And the thing is that they gently approach each other's different ideologies, if you will, different opinions of the world, to come together to some sort of minor agreement at the end, towards the end, because Brad Pitt is expecting to meet the devil himself. And Morgan Freeman says, don't think that way. He's just a man like you and me.
Let's take a clip from it with both of them in it. Morgan Freeman as William Somerset and Brad Pitt playing Detective David Mills. They're looking for information about the serial killer.
Richter's landlord said there was an envelope of cash in the office mailbox the first of every month. Quote, I never heard a single complaint from the tenant in apartment 306. And nobody ever complained about him. He's the best tenant I've ever had. End quote.
Yeah, landlord's dream. Paralyzed tenant with no tongue.
Who pays the rent on time.
sick of all this waiting.
This is the job.
Why are we out there, huh? Why do we gotta sit here, rotting, waiting until the lunatic does it again?
It's dismissive to call him a lunatic. Don't make that mistake.
Come on, he's insane. Look, right now he's probably dancing around in his grandma's panties. Yeah, rubbing himself in peanut butter. Ooh, how's that?
I don't think so.
His luck will run out.
That depending on luck.
Gwyneth Paltrow plays the wife of Mills, played by Brad Pitt. She's kind of the only lightness almost in the whole film, the only real humanity. She invites Somerset around for dinner, and that's kind of the beginning of the kind of entente between the two of them.
That's right, to humanize the two guys outside of work, because that's the only time we see them together. That's when we only see them in life, is when they are working. And it's crucial, I think, the arrival of Tracy is, as you said, the one point of light. And the fact that she is so troubled, she goes for a meeting later on to talk to Morgan Freeman on her own. And she is deeply, deeply troubled by living in the city, where she says, I hate this city. And you can see that she's a small town girl and she's completely out of her depth. And she wants to help her husband's career, to further his career. But she really feels that as a school teacher, this is not the place she wants to see children living or even raise a child of her own.
The violence in the film is almost unique, because we don't see any of the murders and we only witness one actual act of violence in the entire film. All of it takes place in your head.
Yeah, that's the brilliant thing about the movie, because all too often we see an act of violence, but we don't see the impact. And what Fincher did was, and through Avenger Kevin Walker's screenplay, it's the build-up, it's the constant dread of the impending violence. It's never seen, but we always see the aftermath of what happens to the victim. And so you see gluttony, who has been force-fed to death, and greed, who's been bled to death, and you see sloth, who has been, well, atrophied. I don't know how you describe that murder. But you always see the aftermath of death. And this is one of the things that Fincher has tried to explore throughout his career, because he returned to the serial killer picture with Zodiac. And it wasn't really about the search for the serial killer. It was to show the impact that these murders have on people outside of that murder frame. It's complete chaos and the collateral damage of that violence.
I think we actually have David Fincher here talking about the nature of his thoughts on violence in the film.
The greatest thing that all filmmakers need to have is the ability to articulate your intention. You're sculpting behavior over time. You're trying to get everybody to be on the same page, everybody to be in the same movie, everybody to be in the same moment. And that's a lot of work. That's what you're doing. It's a very, very, very powerful medium. A group of people who are mostly strangers are sitting in the dark, and they've given you access to their brains through their eyes and their ears for 2 hours, 2.5 hours. That's a big responsibility. And to me, the audience has to feel it. If they don't feel bad, if they don't feel horrible about violence, it's a problem. I think it's a problem for the movie. I don't want violence in movies to be a joke. I want people to recoil from it and think it's awful.
That's the director, David Fincher. I can't not talk about the look of the film and how it was created, and Darius Conji, the cinematographer.
Yeah, Darius Conji actually began his career as a photographer, stills photographer for perfume commercials. But Fincher was really, really attracted to, because the colour coding that Conju had in his commercials, in the stillboards. And if you look at the colour coding, the colour palette of Seven, there's really only two colours in it. There's brown and green, and there's variations therein. So it's all mouldy, and he's got the sense of decay, and which is a visualization of the moral decay and moral corruption of the serial killer. But in addition to that, what Conji did was they shot the film on digital. They didn't shoot the film digitally; they shot it on celluloid. And so when he sent the celluloid off, the negative off to the baths to be processed, he told them to operate a technique called bleach bypass, which retains the nitrate in the negative, which means you have silvery shadows and you have darker shadows, and you've got black shadows and charcoal shadows. So you've got darkness within the darkness within the darkness, which is the theme of the story.
I remember seeing this film for the first time. I was 22. I saw it in the old Savoy One, and I walked out in the middle of an afternoon feeling like I'd been hit with a sack of doorknobs at the time.
There's a review.
I went back to see it again. But yeah. I mean, how it was received by audiences and critics at the time was quite different.
Yeah, the critics, I mean, I remember reading one critic said, and the eighth deadly sin is boredom. And you get the impression that that critic thought of the smart-ass line before they went in to watch the movie. The audiences, critics were dismissive. They said it was nihilistic, but audiences completely lapped it up. The audiences actually pushed the movie to be a bigger hit than Silence of the Lambs. It earned over $300 million worldwide. But the movie itself has had a huge impact on, unfortunately, a whole lot of really, really poor imitators. But I'll tell you one area that was really strange for me was the imitation. Was there was a Crisps commercial in the 1990s, which had the font was imitating the scratchy credits that you saw in the opening to 70. You say to wonder who's part of that marketing department. But just one little thing about David Fincher's directorial style, because there's so many people who are obsessed with the way he directs movies, and they talk about how many different takes he goes through, 90, 100 takes and all that sort of stuff. But he says when it comes to directing a scene, there's 1,001 different ways you can direct a scene, but there's really only two, and one of them is wrong. And that's Fincher's obsession with the right framing, the right lighting, the right line delivery. And he will go through doing the take again and again and again and again and again and again until the actor delivers it in the perfect pitch that he wants it to hear.
If you have never seen it, you really should. Stephen Benedict, thank you for coming in to talk to us. Thanks, about Rick. Seven, which was released 30 years ago. That's it for tonight's Arena, our special broadcast marking the beginning of ISL Awareness Week as well on the RTE News channel and on rte.ie/arena. Thanks to our ISL interpreter tonight, Catherine White. Gar Duffy was on sound. Leah Murphy researched. Our BCO was Mary Elizabeth Bruton. And our broadcast engineer here tonight was Amy O'Reilly. Tonight's show produced by Reg Luby. I'm Rick O'Shea. John Creedon is next, and I'll talk to you tomorrow night from 7.